Chapter 8. Long practice and a certain natural ability enabled Stephen Maturin to compose a semi-official report of some length in his head, and to encode a condensed version from memory, leaving no potentially dangerous papers after the message itself had gone. This required an exceptional power of recollection, but he had an exceptional power of recollection, and had been trained from boyhood in rote learning. He could repeat the entirety of the Aeneid, and he had the private code by heart, the code, that is to say, in which he and Sir Joseph Blaine, the head of naval intelligence, wrote to one another.
"God between us and evil, my dear Joseph," he began, "but I believe I can report an uncommonly promising beginning, an uncommonly promising situation, with things moving at an extraordinary, dreamlike speed. To begin with, I was introduced to General Hurtado, a former Knight of Malta, who, though a soldier, is very much in favour of independence, partly because Charles IV was rude to his father, but even more because both the present Viceroy and his predecessor seemed to him trifling, ill-bred upstarts. This is not an unusual pattern in Spain, and here the animosity is very much increased by the fact that in a letter the present Viceroy omitted the Excellencia to which Hurtado is by courtesy entitled. Yet what is more unexpected by far is that he is strongly opposed to slavery, and that although he holds a command from which most officers have hitherto retired with enough wealth to ballast the ship that took them back to Spain, he is quite poor. As for his hatred of slavery, he shares it with several of my friends who are also knights of Malta, and I believe it comes from his time in the galleys of the order. And as for the king's rudeness, it consisted of addressing the general's father as my relative, rather than my cousin, which was due to his rank, an offence never to be forgotten, since Hurtado is immeasurably proud. It was indeed the Knights of Malta who brought us cordially well acquainted, for although I had an excellent introduction from a political point of view, it was our many common friends in the order that gave our meetings quite a different aspect. Our common friends and our common attachment to the Sierra Leone scheme for settling liberated slaves, to which we are both subscribers. The first occasion was a ride in the barren wastes that lie beyond the reach of irrigation all round Lima. These expeditions are called hunting, and on feast days the more athletic citizens urge their horses about the stony deserts in search of a more or less fabulous creature said to resemble a hare, and blaze away at the very few things that move, usually a dingy, inedible passerine, which I take to be a dwarvish subspecies of Sternus horridus. I collected 3 beetles for you, of which all I can say is that they belong to the Pentamera, and that I am astonished that even such meagre, attenuated creatures could scrape a living from the desolation we travelled over. The general was more fortunate. He brought down a singularly beautiful tern, the Sterna Inca of Suarez. I can only suppose that it was taking a direct path from a curve in the river to some better fishing ground along the coast, but the event was so rare, so nearly unknown, that it gave the general the utmost satisfaction. He declared there could be no finer omen for our future conversations. A good omen is always welcome, yet if it were not presumptuous, I should feel inclined to say that there is comparatively little doubt about the outcome of these conversations. 3 of the high ecclesiastics and 4 governors being already wholly committed to us, together with those for whom they speak, while the officers in command of the regiments that must be moved are tolerably venal men, and we have ample funds at hand. Yet at the same time, certain forms must still be observed. There must be persuasion, a gentle violence, before they can decently fall.
We are to have a preliminary meeting without these gentlemen on Wednesday to arrange the details of payment and to decide whether Castro should be invited to the main conference on Friday.
He is being very discreetly sounded at this moment in the palace itself, the empty palace, for the Viceroy is hurrying to quell a disturbance in far northern Peru. He left with his military household and some other troops soon after I had met the last of our friends here who were still in Lima, and he is already 10 days' journey along the road. I could not have come at a more fortunate moment, when the Viceroy had alienated so many of the Creoles, and so much of the army, when the desire for independence had risen to such a height, when he was about to remove himself and his surest friends from the capital, and when the ground had been, to a certain extent, prepared. It would perhaps have been wiser to start with Chile,
where Bernardo O'Higgins, close kin to our Vicar General, has so considerable a following. But given the present aspect of affairs, to say nothing of my direct, explicit instructions, I believe we may do very well here. It is true that time is all important, with that smooth coordination of troop movements, declarations, and the summoning of a Peruvian council that will present the Viceroy with a fait accompli on his return, a very well-established fait accompli, with all these movements carried out and an overwhelming force in the citadel. Yet, most fortunately, General Hurtado has an unusual sense of the passing hour, and he is a most capable chief of staff, the most capable in the Spanish service. How I wish I could give you the results of the full conference, or even of the preliminary meeting, but I am to ride into the mountains directly, and the messengers who carry this to the Atlantic coast will be gone before I can be back. May I beg you to send the enclosed half-sheet down to Hampshire? My dear, he wrote on the half-sheet in question, this is the merest hasty scribble to bring you both my fondest love from our most recent port of call, and to tell you that all is well with us except for poor Martin, who has been obliged to be sent home for his health. With the blessing, this note will reach you some 3 months before he arrives. Please tell his wife that I am confident she will see him quite restored. This is a pleasant climate, for gentle sea breezes temper the heat, but they assure me it never rains at all, not at all, ever. And although there are damp fogs throughout the winter, they are not enough to relieve the most total sterility of the desert, stony or sandy, that lies along the coast, the virtual absence of life, animal or vegetable. Yet I have already achieved one of my greatest ambitions. I have seen the condor, and you will be pleased to learn that I have already collected 7 distinct species of mouse. 5 inhabit the fringe of the desert, 1 its very heart, and the 7th was making a nest in my papers. While the rivers, of course, which are fed from the high, far-off snows and which therefore flow their strongest in the summer, provide their valleys and their irrigated fields with a valuable flora and fauna. But it is the high mountain that I long to see, with its plants and creatures unlike any others in the world. At this moment I am booted and spurred for a journey to the moderate heights. My mule stands in a courtyard close at hand, and across his saddle-bow he bears a poncho, an oblong piece of cloth with a hole in the middle, through which I shall put my head when I reach 5 or 6,000 feet. Now God bless you, my dearest love, and pray kiss Bridget for me. He sat back, reflecting with the utmost tenderness upon his wife Diana, that fierce, spirited young woman, and upon their daughter, whom he had not seen but whom he pictured as a very small child in a pinafore, walking by now, perhaps already conversable. Once again his watch broke in upon his wandering thoughts, a watch that would have been a more valuable guide if he had wound it the night before. He folded his papers, carried them into Gyongus's private room, and rehearsed his direction once more.
"You cannot miss it," said Gyongos, "but I wish you may get there before nightfall. You are starting more than 3 hours late."
Stephen bent his head. He could not but admit it.
"And there is a cruel wind blowing right in your face," added Gyongos.
He led Stephen through a deal of passages and stables to a courtyard where the mule was standing. A tall, intelligent animal that recognized their destination after their first 2 or 3 turns through Lima streets, making his way through the gate beyond the Misericordia convent without guidance, and striking into the road that ran a little north of east towards the mountains along the left of the river, a fine, turbulent great stream, growing day by day as the season advanced. The road was not much frequented at present, though on Friday and Saturday it would be full of people going up to the shrine of Our Lady of Huenca, and it grew less beyond the limits of irrigated land. The mule was an ambler with a long, easy motion, and Stephen sat quite relaxed upon his back. The river banks had a reasonable population of birds, while the occasional reptile crossed the road and large flying beetles were common as long as the carob groves lasted. Part of Stephen's mind recorded them, but the strong east wind and the dust made it hard to see with any sharp definition, and in any case the rest of his being was so taken up with the possibility, indeed the strong probability, of a brilliant success for his mission within the next 8 days or even less, that he never stopped or reached for his pocket glass. The whole scheme had matured so quickly, because of his excellent relations with Hurtado and O'Higgins, and above all because of the Viceroy's departure, that his spirits, usually so well under control, were now in something of a fluster. This was a condition he had seen often enough in his colleagues, but finding it in himself put him somewhat out of countenance. Once more he went over the various moves, the replacing of stated regiments by others, the convocation of wholly committed supporters, the summoning of a council, the issue of a proclamation, the rapid dispatch of guns to command three essential bridges. As he named them in order, they seemed simple enough, and his heart beat so that he could hear it. Yet he had some acquaintance with the military mind, the Spanish military mind, and with that of the Spanish conspirator. And before now he had seen a series of actions that were simple in themselves, but that had of necessity to be carried out in sequence, fall into hopeless chaos for want of a sense of time, for want of common efficiency, or because of hidden jealousies. He wished he had not used such confident, presumptuous words in writing to Blaine. From very early times men had believed that it was unwise, even impious, to tempt fate. The ancient generations were not to be despised. The confident system of his youth, universal reform, universal changes, universal happiness and freedom, had ended in something very like universal tyranny and oppression. The ancient generations were not to be despised, and the seaman's firm belief that Friday was unlucky was perhaps less foolish than the philosoph's conviction that all the days of the week could be rendered happy by the application of an enlightened system of laws. He wished the main conference had not been set for Friday. Blushing at his momentary weakness, he turned his mind to Hurtado. The general might have some small absurdities, such as a delight in being fine. He wore the stars of his three orders at all times, and setting an inordinate value on pedigree. He took more pleasure in recounting the stages of his descent, through his maternal grandmother, from Wilfred the Shaggy, than in speaking of the four brilliant victories he had won as commander, or the other battles in which he had served with such distinction. On all other subjects, however, he was not only a rational being, but one with an unusually acute and ready mind, an active man, a born organizer, and an uncommonly effective ally in such a concern. His abilities, his known honesty, his high reputation in the army, and his influence throughout Peru made him the most valuable friend that ever Stephen could have found. The white milestones filed by, and many crosses commemorating death by earthquake, murder, accident. For some little while the mule had not been pacing uphill with the same steady determination. He had been gazing from side to side. And now, giving Stephen a significant look, he turned off the road into the last carob trees. By this point the road had wound some way from the Rimac, which could be heard roaring in the gorge below, but a small tributary stream ran through among the trees, and in this Stephen and the mule drank heartily.
"You are a good, honest creature, sure, and you bear an excellent character," said Stephen. "So I shall take off your saddle, confident you will not play the fool."
The mule flung himself to the ground and rolled, waving his legs, and while Stephen sat under the lee of a carob's wall, each tree was surrounded by what looked like a wellhead, grazed on what meagre herbage the grove could provide. Stephen ate bread and good Peruvian cheese with Peruvian wine, and in doing so he thought of the little girls, their apology the next day. Sarah.
"Sir, we are come to ask pardon for our wicked drunken folly."
Emily.
"For our wanton drunken folly."
And their words to Mr. Wilkins, their voices piping alternately, clearly audible from below when Stephen had been chivied right forward by Pullings and Mr. Adams, who were bargaining with some merchants who wished to buy the Alistair.
"Yes, sir, and after mass, there was an organ. Do you know what an organ is, sir? We went aboard a grand carriage drawn by mules with purple harness together with the doctor and Father Panda. There was a square with a lady on a column in the middle. The column was 40 foot high, and the lady was made of bronze. She had a trumpet and water came out of it, and it came out of 8 lions' heads too. Out of 12 lions' heads, booby. It was surrounded by 6 huge enormous iron chains, and 4 and 20 12-pounders. The merchants paved 2 of the streets with silver ingots once. They weighed 10 pounds apiece, about 1 foot long, 4 inches broad, and 2 or 3 inches deep.
He had nearly finished his meal when he felt the mule's breath on the back of his neck. Then the long, smooth, large-eyed face came down and delicately took the last piece of bread from his knee, a crust.
"You are a sort of tame mule, I find," he said.
And indeed the creature's gentleness, The kind way in which he stood to be saddled and his fine, willing stride gave Stephen a higher opinion of his owner, the Vicar General, an austere man in his ordinary dealings. The mule's name was Joselito. Stephen mounted. Out of the grove there was more wind now, more wind by far, right in their faces, and the road climbed, winding and forever rising with tall, very tall, many-branched columnal cactuses on either side, and little else apart from smaller cactuses with even crueller thorns. This was the first time in Stephen's life that he had ever ridden in a strange country, paying so little attention to his surroundings. And although on occasion he had had a hand, even a directing hand, in matters of great importance, this was the first time that so much depended on his success, and the first time that the crisis, the decision, was drawing so near with such speed. He did not even notice two barefoot friars, though the mule had been pointing his ears in their direction for a quarter of a mile, until he was almost upon them, and they standing on an outward corner, their beards streaming in the wind, looking back to the sound of hoofs. He pulled off his hat, called out a greeting, and pushed on, hearing their "Go with God!" as he turned in yet another traverse, the road now high up on the steep side of the valley, with the stream a great way below. He met a few small, scattered groups, Indians coming down from the high pasture, and presently the road climbed to a saddle where the wind, a cold wind now, took them with great force. Before crossing it, he steered Joselito into a less exposed hollow, where travellers before him had lighted fires, burning whatever little scrub they could find. Here, at what he judged to be some 5,000 feet, he gave the mule his other loaf. No great sacrifice, since anxiety of a vague, diffused nature had eaten his own appetite, and put on the poncho, a simple garment with no sleeves, easier to manage than a cloak. The sky was still a fine light blue above them, unclouded here by dust. Before him, when he turned, stretched the foothills and the plain, somewhat veiled, with the Rimac running through it to the immense Pacific, the coastline as clear as a map, and the island of San Lorenzo, beyond Callao, rising sharply from it, with the sun directly beyond, 2 hours from the somewhat blurred horizon. No ships in the offing that he could see, but below him on the road, no great way off, there was a party of horsemen. Quite a large party, bound no doubt for the monastery of San Pedro, or that of San Pablo, both of them in the mountains far ahead, and both of them frequented for retreats, particularly by soldiers. The poncho was a comfort. So was the way the road went down after they had crossed the saddle to a new valley with higher, farther mountains rising beyond, range after range. But this did not last long. Soon it began to rise once more, and they climbed steadily, mile after mile, sometimes so steeply that Stephen dismounted and walked beside the mule. And steadily the landscape grew more mineral. "I wish I had paid more attention to geology," said Stephen, for on his right hand, on the far side of the gorge, the bare mountainside showed a great band of red, brilliant in the declining sun, against the grey rock below and the black above. "Would that be porphyry at all?" On and on, up and always up. The air was thinner by now, and Joselito was breathing deep. Before they crossed the head of this valley, they passed a man in a cloak whose horse had apparently both lost a shoe and picked up a stone. There was no telling, since he led his animal limping off the road and stood behind it, well out of hail. Of infinitely greater consequence was the prospect of yet another blessed downward stretch on the far side of the pass. Yet here Stephen, if not the mule, was disappointed, for this before them was not the last valley, but only the prelude to an even higher range, and still the road climbed. A new and immediate anxiety added itself to the rest in Stephen's head and bosom, that of being benighted. Already the sun was low behind them. There was twilight down there in the lowest part of their present valley, and the western sky was assuming a violet tinge. Another half hour, a hard half hour, with Joselito grunting as he strode on, and there before them was a new ridge and the parting of the ways. The road split into two thinner paths, that on the right leading to the Benedictine house of San Pedro, the other to the Dominicans of San Pablo. Shading his eyes against the powerful wind, Stephen could see them both, quite clearly, a hand's breadth above the rising shadow of the night. Without the least hesitation, Joselito took the right-hand path, and Stephen was glad of it. He respected the Dominican's austere way of life, but he knew just how far Spanish piety could go, and he had no wish to share their severity tonight.
"It would not have seemed so far if I had not been so long at sea," he said aloud. "But as it is, I am destroyed entirely. What a delight to think of a good supper, a glass of wine, and a warm bed."
The mule caught his cheerfulness, if not his literal meaning, and pressed on with renewed energy. It was still only twilight, but darkening fast when they came to the convent. Outside the grey wall before the gate, a tall, solitary figure was pacing to and fro, and the mule ran the last 100 yards or so, uttering a feeble, hoarse noise he could utter no more, and nuzzled the vicar general's shoulder. Father O'Higgins's particularly Irish clerical face, humourless and stern, changed to a look of simple pleasure, much of which remained when he turned to Stephen, now dismounted, and asked him whether he had had a pleasant ride, whether it had not seemed too long with this untimely wind.
"Not at all, father," said Stephen. "If I had not been so fresh from the sea, with my legs unused to the unyielding ground, it would not have seemed a great way at all, far from it indeed, particularly with so grand and high-stepping a mule as Joselito. God bless him."
"God bless him," said Father O'Higgins, patting the mule's withers.
"Yet the wind makes me anxious for those at sea. We can take shelter where they cannot."
"Very true, very true," said the priest, and the wind howled over the convent wall. "Poor souls! God be with them!"
"Amen,"
said Stephen, and they walked in. Compline, at St. Pedro's, was traditionally very long, and the choir monks were still singing the Nunc Dimittis when Stephen was woken and led through passages behind the chapel. The pure, impersonal, clear, plain chant, rising and falling, moved his sleepy mind. The strong, cold east wind outside the postern cleared it entirely. The path led him and the others, a line of lanterns, over a ridge behind the monastery and down into the high but comparatively fertile plateau beyond. Excellent grazing, he had been told, and so towards a large summering house, a borda or sheiling, ordinarily used by those who looked after the flocks. From the low voices before and behind him, Stephen gathered that some men must have come in not only after his arrival, but after he had gone to bed. Presently he saw a similar line of lanterns coming down from San Pablo, and the two little groups joined in the barn-like sheiling, friends recognizing one another with low, discreet greetings and feeling their way towards the benches. Few lights and those high up. First, there was a long prayer, chanted, to Stephen's surprise, by the ancient prior of the Matucana Capuchins. He had not known that the movement had so wide a base as to reconcile Franciscan and Dominican. The proceedings themselves did not interest him very much. There was clearly much to be said for admitting Castro, but equally clearly there was much to be said against it. Stephen did not possess enough knowledge either of Castro or of those who were speaking for or against his admission to form an opinion of much value. In any case, he did not think it mattered a great deal one way or another. The support or opposition of so ambiguous a character was neither here nor there, now that great armed forces were about to be moved. He listened to the general line, however, sometimes dozing, although the backless bench was a cruel seat for his weary frame, until with relief he heard Hurtado's strong, soldierly voice.
"No, no, gentlemen, it will not do. There is no trusting a man who watches the cat so long and closely to see which way it will jump. If we succeed, he will join us. If we do not, he will denounce us. Remember José Rivera."
"That seems to have settled the question," reflected Stephen. "What joy!"
And soon after, one line set out for San Pedro, another for San Pablo, lit by a lopsided moon, which was just as well, the wind being now so strong that lanterns could not be relied on. Dear bed again, a remote sense of prime being sung, then an Indian lay brother with a basin of quite warm water, early mass, and breakfast in the small refectory. His neighbours were the vicar general, who greeted him kindly, but who was taciturn at most times, and even more so in the morning, and Father Gomez, who was not taciturn at all, though from his impassive, markedly Indian face, a brown Roman emperor, he might well have been. He drank a large quantity of mate from a gourd, observing,
"I know, my dear sir, that it is a waste of time trying to wean you from your coffee, but allow me to pass you these dried apricots from Chile. These dried Chilean apricots.
And after another gourd, he said,
I remember too that you spoke of your wish to see the high mountain and some of the great Inca buildings. This, of course, is not the high mountain, yet it does approach some quite lofty ground. Not the Puna, you understand, but quite lofty. And my nephew will be here this morning to look at one of our llama stations. If only the weather were not so disagreeable, he could show you something of the country. I spoke of you when last we met, and he begged me to present him. Ah, cried he, clasping his hands, someone at last who can tell me of the birds of the Southern Ocean.
I shall be charmed to tell him what little I know, said Stephen, and surely the weather is not so very severe.
Eduardo would not think so, replied Father Gomez, but then he is a great hunter, and he creeps up mountains through ice and snow. He is made of brass. He had climbed Pichincha, Chimborazo, Cotopaxi itself.
Stephen had rarely taken to a new acquaintance as he took to Eduardo. To be sure, he had always liked the friendly, straightforward, wholly unaffected young on those few occasions he had met them. But here these rare and amiable qualities were combined with a deep interest in living things, birds, animals, reptiles, even plants, and a surprising knowledge of those of his own immense and immensely varied country. Not that Eduardo was so very young, either. Such a mass of experience could not be accumulated in a few years, but he had retained the directness, modesty, and simplicity that so often disappear as time goes on. Furthermore, he spoke a perfectly fluent, but agreeably accented Spanish filled with pleasant archaisms, which reminded Stephen of the English in the former northern colonies, though Eduardo's language lacked the somewhat metallic overtones of Boston. They sat in the cloister with their backs to the east wall, and when Stephen had told him all he knew about albatrosses, which was not inconsiderable, he having sat with them for hours at their nesting places on Desolation Island, sometimes lifting them off to look closely at their eggs, all he knew, particularly about their flight, Eduardo spoke with great eagerness of the guacharo, a very singular bird he had discovered in a vast cavern near Cajamarca in the Andes. A vast cavern indeed, but scarcely large enough for the prodigious number of guacharos that tried to get in, so that some were left outside. It was one of these that Eduardo came upon, fast asleep at noon in the darkest place it could find, the hollow underside of a fallen tree. A bird about the size of a crow, something like a nightjar, something like an owl, brown and grey, flecked with white and black, large-winged, fast-flying. A strictly nocturnal bird, yet feeding solely on oily nuts, seeds, and fruit.
"You astonish me!" cried Stephen.
"I too was dumbfounded," replied Eduardo. "Yet such is the case. In the season of the year the people of the village climb up to the cave, take all the young they can reach, mere balls of fat, and melt them down for oil, a pure transparent oil which they use for lamps or for cooking. They showed me the cauldron, and they showed me the brimming oil jars, astonished at my ignorance. I went far into the cave, wearing a broad hat against their droppings, and while they screeched and clattered over my head, it was like being in the midst of a huge swarm of bees, gigantic bees, and a din so that one could hardly think. I saw a small forest of wretched, light-starved, dwarfish trees sprung from seeds they had voided.
"Please tell me of their eggs," said Stephen, for whom this was a cardinal taxonomic point.
"They are white and unshining like an owl's, and they have no sharp end. But they are laid in a well-shaped, rounded nest made of... What is it?" he asked a hovering lay brother. "There is a gentleman who would like to see the doctor," said the lay brother, handing a card. It bore an agreed name, and Stephen excused himself. "He is cooling his horse outside the gatehouse," said the lay brother.
There were two or three other people doing the same after their ride up the last steep hill, and Stephen had to look quite hard before he made out Gayongus in military uniform, cavalry moustache, and a great slouch hat, which surprised him, disguise being almost unknown at this level of intelligence. But he had to admit that although unprofessional, it was effective. Gayongus had a powerful, well-lathered stone horse in his hand. The animal had clearly come up the road at a great pace.
"A man called Dutor has reached Lima from Callao," he said in a low tone as they walked the horse up and down. "He is running about, saying that he was ill-treated as a prisoner in the surprise, ill-treated and robbed, that Captain Aubrey is not what he seems, that the surprise is not a privateer, but a king's ship, and that you are probably a British agent. He has found out some of the French mission, and he harangued them in a loud voice in Hooly Breeson's crowded coffee-house until they became uneasy and walked off. Then he told another tale about an ideal projected republic. He makes a great deal of noise. His Spanish is incorrect, but ready enough. He says he is an American, and he had a privateer sailing under American colours.
How did he get away, I wonder? Asked Stephen inwardly. The probable answer came at once.
It is vexing, he said to Gayongas, and at an earlier time it might have been most inconvenient, even disastrous, but now it is of no great consequence. The French will never take him seriously, will never compromise themselves with such a talkative enthusiast, with such a fool. He is incapable of keeping quiet, nor will anyone else. In any case, I believe things have moved too far to be affected by his vapours. Consider, any complaint, any representations that he may make would have to be dealt with by the civil authorities. In a matter of 24 hours or so, a military government will have taken power, and until independence is proclaimed, the civil authorities will not exist.
Yes, said Gayongas. That was my view, but I thought you ought to be told. How did the meeting go?
It was decided not to admit Castro.
Gayongas nodded, but his face was somewhat doubtful as he remounted.
What shall I do with Dutol? He asked. Shall I have him suppressed? He makes such a noise.
No, denounce him to the Inquisition, said Stephen, smiling. He is a most infernal heretic.
Gayongas, however, was not much given to merriment, and there was no answering smile on his face as he set off in a shower of small stones and a cloud of dust for San Pablo to give his journey another face. The dust drifted westward, perceptibly slower than would have done a few hours earlier.
Their nest is made of mud, said Eduardo,
and while Stephen was digesting this, he prepared a ball of coca leaves, passed his soft leather bag, and observed,
The wind is dropping somewhat.
So it is indeed,
said Stephen, glancing at a group of people who had just come into the cloister. Early pilgrims were beginning to arrive in both monasteries.
I hope you will not find your journey to the Lama farm too arduous.
Oh, not at all, though I thank you for your kindness. I am accustomed to the mountain, even to the Puna, the very high mountain, though I confess that such a blow at this time of the year and on this side of the Cordillera is almost unheard of. How I wish it would drop a little more. And from this sky I believe it may, so that you might be induced to come at least as far as Hualpo, our main Lama station.
Fortified by coca leaves, I should have no hesitation in setting out within the next quarter of an hour, said Stephen. Once their virtuous principle is infused into my whole being, I shall bear my bosom to the blast with perfect equanimity. It will not be long. Already I feel that agreeable insensibility invading my pharynx. But first pray tell me about the Lama. I am pitifully ignorant of the whole tribe, have never seen a living specimen, and only very few indifferent bones.
Well, sir, there are only two wild kinds, the Vicuña, a little orange creature with a long silky fleece that lives high up, close to the snow, though sometimes we see a few above Hualpo, and the Guanaco. We see some of them, too. Where would the Puma be were it not for the Guanaco? But they are more usual in Chile, and right down to Patagonia. They are more easily tamed than the Vicuña, and they are the ancestors of the Llama and the Alpaca. The llamas being bred for riding and carrying burdens, and the alpaca, smaller animals that we keep higher up, just for wool. Both give quite good meat, of course, though some say not nearly as good as mutton. In my opinion, mutton.
He coughed, blew his nose, and rolled another ball of coca leaves. But to a reasonably attentive, sympathetic listener, it was clear that the Inca, for Eduardo was of the pure blood, regarded sheep as an unwelcome Spanish introduction. This became more apparent later in the day, when they rode eastward across the plateau, and rounding a knoll studded with the tallest, many-branched cactuses Stephen had yet seen, came upon a flock, gathered in a sheltered hollow, grazing close together, all facing one way. For the last few miles Eduardo had been talking away with the greatest animation, telling Stephen of a white-muzzled bear he had once met in a coca grove, and pointing out a variety of small birds. This country, though bare, was very far from being the desert of the coastal plain. But his cheerful face changed on seeing the flock running away, all in the same direction.
Sheep. Well, may they be called sheep,
he said indignantly, and putting his fingers to his mouth, he uttered a piercing whistle which set them running faster still. This brought the Indian shepherds out from behind the rocks, and while one, with the dogs, brought the sheep to order, the others raced towards the horses, calling out in submissive tones. But Eduardo rode on, and it was some minutes before he recovered his gaiety, describing the lake of Chinchaycocha, no great way farther to the east, but something of a climb, being at 13,000 feet. It was surrounded by reed beds, and it had a wonderful population of waterfowl.
"But unhappily," he said, "I know their names only in Quechua, the language of my people. I have found no learned descriptions with Latin names, genus, and species. For example, there is a splendid goose we call huachua, which has dark green wings merging to violet."
The plateau broke away in broad, sloping terraces to a stream far below. And here the country was richer by far, with fields of a crop called quinoa, a species of quinopodium, and fields of barley with dry stone walls, stone in great plenty, lying in shattered heaps, and on the edge of one field a stray sheep.
"Sheep again," said Eduardo with disapproval.
Down the stream, far on the right hand, there was an Indian village, but he turned to the left, telling Stephen a little anxiously that although the lofty slope on the other side looked high, it was not really very steep or far, that the llama farm was only just over the top, really a little low for llamas, and this path would get them there much quicker. So it did, but only, as far as Stephen was concerned, at the cost of much gasping and great concentration as he led his horse up the cruel, shaly track, keeping up with Eduardo's elastic step as well as he could, but necessarily losing his explanation of several small birds and plants and a lizard. Beetles crossed the path, unexamined, uncollected. As they climbed, they were under the lee of the eastern wall. They could hear the wind high overhead, but they felt no more than the occasional eddy, and in the still, thin, clear air the sun beat down. Whenever Eduardo found that he had drawn more than a few yards ahead, he paused to cough or blow his nose, and this was the first time Stephen had ever known consideration for his age cause a young man to check his pace. He took another ball of coca leaves, bent his head, and watched his feet. Although his words to Gayongos had been perfectly sound, the wretched Dutor would thrust his way up into some level of Stephen's mind just below full consciousness, an unreasonable, haunting anxiety. Physical exertions helped. The coca leaves had their usual charming effect, but it was not until a great gust struck him that he realized that they were at the top, and that the anxiety gave way to a lively interest in the present.
"Here we are!" cried Eduardo.
And there they were indeed, massy stone buildings on yet another high plateau, corrals, distant herds. An Indian girl mounted on a llama who threw herself off and came running to kiss Eduardo's knee. Stephen was led to a respectable barn, seated on a faggot covered with a herb related to ladies' bedstraw, and handed a gourd of mate with a silver tube. The Indians were perfectly civil and obliging, but they had no smile for him. This had been the case with all the few Indians he had met, a gloomy nation by all appearances, unsocial, quite withdrawn. It was therefore with some amazement that he observed their delight in Eduardo's presence, their cheerfulness, and even, in spite of their profound respect, their laughter, which he had never heard before. Eduardo spoke to them only in Quechua, which came trippingly off his tongue. He had apologized to Stephen beforehand, saying that most of them did not know Spanish, and that some of those who did preferred to conceal their knowledge. Now, however, turning to Stephen, he said in that language,
"Sir, allow me to show you a guanaco in the field outside. He is the wild ancestor of the llama, as you will recall, but this one was caught young, and now he is quite tame."
"A fine animal," said Stephen, looking at the slim, elegant, fawn-coloured, white-bellied creature, which held its long neck high and returned his gaze quite fearlessly. "About 12 hands, I believe."
12 hands exactly, sir. And here, coming up the path, is our best llama. His name in Quechua means spotless snow."
"An even finer animal," said Stephen, turning to watch the llama walk delicately up the path with an Indian boy, balancing its head delicately from side to side.
He had barely fixed his attention upon the llama, estimating its height and weight, before the guanaco, gathering itself, bounded forward with both front knees bent, and struck him a little below the shoulder blades, sending him flat on his face. In the general outcry, while Stephen was picked up and dusted, and the guanaco led away by the ears, the lama stood unmoved, looking scornful.
"Mother of God!" cried Eduardo. "I am so sorry, so ashamed!"
"It is nothing, nothing at all," said Stephen. "A childish tumble on the grass, no more. Let us ask the lama how he does." The lama stood his ground as they approached, eyeing Stephen with much the same look as the guanaco, and when he was well within range, spat in his face. The aim was perfect, the saliva extraordinarily copious. Outcry and hullabaloo again, but only Eduardo seemed really deeply moved, and as Stephen was being washed and wiped, he saw two Indian children in the far background fairly twisting themselves double with delight.
"What can I say?" said Eduardo. "I am desolated, desolated. It is true they sometimes do that to people who vex them, and sometimes to white men who do not. I should have thought of it. But after we had been talking for a while, I forgot your colour."
"May I beg for some mate?" asked Stephen. "That most refreshing drink?"
"Instantly, instantly!" cried Eduardo,
and coming back with a gourd, he said,
"Just beyond that small sharp peak is where we keep the alpacas. From there one can sometimes see a band of vicuñas, and quite often, too, the small fluttering rock creeper we call a pito. It is no great way, and I had hoped to carry you up there, but now I am afraid it is too late, and perhaps you have had enough of llamas and their kind."
"Not at all, not at all!" cried Stephen. "But it is true that I must not be late at the convent."
Going down, Eduardo grew sadder as they lost height. His spirits declined with the slope of the path, and as they rested among the shattered boulders of another gigantic rockfall, the result of the most recent earthquake and barely lichened yet, Stephen, to divert his mind, said,
"I was pleased to see your people so happy and gay. I had formed a false notion from my trifling experience in and about Lima, supposing them to be almost morose."
"A people that has had its ancient laws and customs taken from it, whose language and history count for nothing, and whose temples have been sacked and thrown down, is apt to be morose," replied Eduardo.
Then, recollecting himself,
"I do not say that this is the state of affairs in Peru, and it would be the grossest heresy to deny the benefits of the true religion. I say only that this is what some of the more obstinate Indians who may secretly practice the old sacrifices believe, and—"
"Pray do not move," he said in a low, urgent voice, nodding towards the far side of the valley, there where the terraces and fields ran down to the stream. Against the mountain, a band of condors were circling, rising, but to no great height, and as Stephen watched, three of them perched on convenient rocks.
"If you train your little spyglass on the edge of the barley half way down," said Eduardo, in little more than a whisper, "you will see the stray sheep."
Stephen rested the glass in a crack between two rocks, brought the edge of the field into focus, travelled down to a patch of white, but there was a tawny puma covering most of it, slowly eating mutton.
"They often do that," murmured Eduardo. "The condors come quite soon after he has killed his prey. They seem to watch him as he travels, and wait until he is gorged. Then he creeps off into shelter and they come down. But he cannot bear seeing them at it. He rushes out, they rise. He eats a little more, retires, and they return. There, he is going off already."
"Our vultures are more circumspect," said Stephen. "They will wait for hours, whereas these are in directly. Lord, how they eat! I should not have missed this for the world. Thank you, my dear Eduardo, for showing me the puma, that noble beast."
Riding back, they discussed the whole event in minute detail, the exact angle and splay of the condor's primaries as they settled on a crag, the movement of their tails, the dissatisfied look on the puma's face when it came back for the third time to nothing but a heap of the larger bones. Having talked themselves hoarse, almost shouting over the declining but still powerful wind, they reached the monastery in reasonable time. Here they supped with a numerous company in the main refectory, and Stephen retired to his cell as soon as grace was said. He had not eaten much, he had drunk less, and now, another usual consequence of ingesting coca, he lay unsleeping, but not unhappy with it, his mind running over the day just past, regretting the untimely, though surely unimportant, du tour, but taking much pleasure in the rest. At the same time he followed the chanting of the monks. This particular Benedictine house was unusually rigorous, separating matins from lauds, singing the first at midnight, a very long service indeed with the full nocturne, lessons and Te Deum, and the second so that its middle psalm coincided with the rising of the sun. He was in a half-sleep, thinking of Condorcet, a very, very much larger man than Dutor, but equally foolish in his regard for that silly villain Rousseau, when his ear caught a footstep in the passage, and he was wide awake when Sam came in, holding a shaded candle. He was about to make some remark in Jack Aubrey's style, such as, "Have you come up to the monastery, Sam?" when Sam's gravity quenched his smile.
"Forgive me for waking you, sir, but Father O'Higgins begs he might have a word."
"Certainly he may," said Stephen. "Pray pass me my breeches in the corner there. As you see, I lie in my shirt."
"Doctor," said the Vicar General, rising and placing a chair, "you know there is a clandestine French mission to the Independentists here."
Stephen bowed.
"They have recently been joined, or rather, sought out, by a noisy, talkative enthusiast who has already thrown much discredit on them. I believe they will slip out of the country, and who has almost directly asserted that you are a British agent. It is true that the Holy Office has taken him up for some shocking blasphemies in the style of Condorcet uttered in public, but Castro has already seized upon the event to ingratiate himself with the Viceroy. 'Heretical foreign gold,' he cries. He has had one small mob bawling outside the British consulate, and another has broken the windows of the house where the Frenchmen were staying. Until the Viceroy comes back he can do no more, and General Hurtado will probably knock him on the head tomorrow. I mean reduce him to silence. But the General is not to be found in Lima, nor is he at his brother's. He is much given to gallantry. We shall not see him until the conference at noon, and although I think it is weakness on my part, I feel somewhat uneasy. A man of Castro's stamp is incapable of doing much good, but he may do a great deal of harm, and I think we were unwise in rejecting him. I tell you these things because if you share my weakness, you may wish to take your measures in the event of our being right."
Stephen made suitable acknowledgements and observed,
"As far as regretting the rejection of an unreliable man is concerned, I think you may be mistaken. He could never have been trusted, and he would have come into the possession of a great many names."
He returned to his cell carrying pens, ink, and a quire of paper, and as he went he reflected on the unsoundness of his words. The rest of the night he spent writing. At sunrise, still not at all sleepy, he folded his papers, put them into his bosom, and walked into the chapel to hear the Benedictus. In the later part of the morning, large numbers of people began to arrive at the two monasteries, many of them pilgrims coming early for the exposition, some of them members of the League, among whom there was a general tendency to silence and anxious looks. Messengers had been posted on the road to intercept General Hurtado with a letter telling him of Castro's activities, so that he should be prepared to reassure the meeting and to take instant, decisive measures. He did not come. In his place there appeared Gayongos, old, grey, his face destroyed. He told Stephen, the Vicar General, Father Gomez and Sam that Hurtado, extremely moved, had declared that with these cries of foreign gold abroad repeated on every hand and in this atmosphere of corruption, he could not, as a man of honour, consider any further action at this moment. They wasted no time in expostulation. Stephen asked whether Castro could possibly seize the ship.
"Certainly not," said Father O'Higgins. "Not until the Viceroy returns, and even then it is extremely improbable. But he may well risk a provisional arrest of your person on some pretext or other. You must go to Chile. I have prepared a letter to my kinsman Bernardino for you. He will take you to Valparaiso, where you can go on board your ship."
"Eduardo will show you the way," said Father Gomez. "You will be in no danger with him," he added with a curious smile.
Turning to Gayongos, Stephen asked whether any of the actual treasure had been transferred.
"No," said Gayongos, "apart from a few thousands. Nothing but drafts on the provisional government. The gold was to have been distributed tomorrow afternoon."
"Then pray retain it in a readily immovable form until you receive word," said Stephen.
And to Sam,
"Father Panda, here is the merest note for Captain Aubrey. He will be in quite soon, I am sure, and you will explain things far better than I could do."
They all shook hands, and in the doorway Gayongos said,
I feel so much for your disappointment. Pray accept this parting gift.
Silent tears, utterly astonishing on that grey, dew-lapped face, ran down as he handed Stephen an envelope.